You're in OC?
Yep.
Okay. I put it here, yeah. Good morning. It is a great pleasure to be back here again at MFM to see some familiar faces and friendly faces. Yes, I want to, I'm very grateful and thankful this morning to, for the, again, the opportunity to share a reflection that is that brings to life and to the forefront some of our partners that that we work with in Colombia. Now, be patient with me. I like I said, John takes all the blame for this. So I don't necessarily start off on the most thankful note. Today we gather to reflect on what it means to be thankful. I must admit that I've had sometimes some misgivings about this holiday, as in some settings it represents remembering how European settlers gave thanks to the bounty they harvested, but unfortunately to the detriment of First Nations. And far too often it is a feast of delicious foods, where we eat far too much, and well represented here, and make jokes about wearing special Thanksgiving pants and to make more room while many lack even enough to eat one meal. A world where growing polarization, fear of others, war, and climate crisis can leave us feeling desperate. Sometimes I catch myself cursing humankind and most definitely not feeling very thankful. A cartoon was going around recently where animals were standing in front of the doorway of the ark, and Noah and his family are standing below, and the animals look down and say, "Hey, maybe we'll give it a try without you this time." Considering how the world is going, that might not be the worst option. This past year in Colombia, many of us have felt a deep sense of despair, as we have seen things take a serious change for worse. In 2016, the government and the largest guerrilla group, FARC, signed an agreement that many felt would help Colombia take a serious step towards ending the more than 60-year-old conflict. It was hailed as one of history's most complete agreements. Maritza, my wife, and I watched the signing of the agreements live on TV with our daughters, Vanya and Isabel, and explained to them the importance of this moment and how it could mean that they would not have to face many of the problems that mommy had to face growing up in the midst of war. We were hopeful and thankful. The numbers of reported killings and injury due to the armed conflict dropped to almost nothing. We were all breathing deeply and giving thanks that things were changing. Unfortunately, powerful forces led by Álvaro Uribe Vélez were successful through deception and lies to have 51% of Colombians vote against the agreements in a referendum. The agreements were then pushed into the Constitution through Congress, but the referendum set a stage to elect Uribe's protege, Iván Duque, and his policies into the presidency. Although he has an obligation to implement the agreements, Duque has done everything in his power to make sure the agreements are not implemented, underfunding the institutions and programs created by the agreements. Since the signing of the agreements in 2016, over 750 community, social, and human rights leaders have been assassinated. Areas that we were finally feeling some relief from war have been heavily militarized once again. Destructive war on drug policies that had been canceled are once again being discussed and could soon be implemented. If you add into the mix scandals of mass corruption where billions are reported to have been stolen by the wealthy, while millions suffer from lack of basic services such as water and food. What is there to be grateful for? So at this point, you might be wondering who in the world invited this guy on Thanksgiving Sunday. Well, like I said, it was John. You might be thinking, hey, yeah, the world is messed up, but come on, man. There has to be something to be thankful for, or we might as well just cash in our chips and go home. And sometimes that's exactly how I feel. Let's cash in the chips and call it quits. But then in my worst moments of despair and lack of feeling thankful, I remember the words of our partner in Haiti, who said, despair is a privilege of the privileged. In spite of having lived over 60 years of civil war, Colombians like to mention that they have been named the happiest country in the world. I'm not sure how this is determined, but if the fact that they feel this way is a sign that they are willing to continue struggling for what they want in the middle of adversity. When I take a moment to pause and I reflect, I realize that I have much to be thankful for. My beautiful wife and daughters, my family and friends and community of supporters, such as you. The people from the organizations and communities CPT partners with in Colombia, who simply refuse to give up, even when it seems completely hopeless, to continue and have been doing so all their lives. And I want to share a few stories with you about these people this morning. So the first slide that you have here is the picture of Juan Manuel Santos on that side, and Timochenko, the supreme commander of the FARC, here shaking hands in Cartagena in October of 2016. The world community gathered. Everyone dressed in white, the color of peace. World dignitaries, presidents, Stéphane Dion, foreign minister at the time of Canada, was there. And thousands of civil society were gathered. Victims were present on the stage, choirs and youth performing plays representing this new change that Colombia was going to experience. We watched it, as I said, live in our living room with the girls and shed many tears. Maritza, well, I've been there since 2001, and we heard our partners. There will never be an agreement. The FARC and the government gave a go at it several times, but they just always went back to guns. But this time, the UN Security Council signed off on it. John Paul Lederach and several experts on conflict resolution hailed it, as I said, as one of the top 10 agreements. Some even said the top 3 agreements in history in terms of having dealt with the holistic issues of the root causes of the conflict. And so we had a lot of hope. This man, Álvaro Uribe Vélez, former president from 2002 to 2010, had the most militaristic policies in the history of Colombia. Internally displaced people jumped about 2 million people under his watch. Thousands of people were assassinated under a policy of passing people off, civilians being passed off as guerrillas killed in combat, and gross human violations went through the roof. And he led, as I said, a campaign of deception and lies, admitted by their own campaign manager when there was the campaign leading for the referendum as to yes or no, do we want these agreements? And as I said, 51% of the country voted against it. So Duque was then elected elected president. And now we're going back to the policies of Álvaro Uribe Vélez. So where do we find hope? Why Why are we not cashing in the chips and going home? Well, our partners who we work with, people who were born and raised. These are all people who were born into the conflict. It's over 60 years old. And so they've known nothing else. And sometimes you think they have no other choice. So that's the way you just do it. But these are amazing people. It's not just because they have no other choice. There are other choices. You can take up a gun and join the armed revolution. You can just give up and try to live a normal life and keep a low profile and not be targeted because you choose to stand up for others. And, well, they have chosen to do so. And so let me show you some of their stories. Carlos Giordano Morales. He's a young man who at the age of 18 or 19 decided that the communities in the south, northeast Antioquia region, they needed training and understanding what their rights are to be able to live and defend themselves in their territory. He understood that it is not right for companies to come in or armed men to come into their communities and simply chase them off. He said, no, we got to do something about this. And so he and others of the region got together and formed Calcupana. That's the acronym. And decided to train themselves and then train others in their communities. But to do so very quickly led to threats against their lives. And so they look for allies, such as CPT, to accompany them as they go from community to community, go to government offices, and hear four people from Calcupana, four leaders of Calcupana, were assassinated under this policy of false positives. They were dressed up in military, in camouflage, put a gun beside them, and then reported as guerrillas. But Calcupana successfully proved them wrong and put military personnel in prison. But because they did this, they were heavily threatened. And here we are with the CPT delegation standing in front of the doors of the battalion responsible for these assassinations. And Carlos Giordano is boldly standing before the military officers and saying, you did this. We know you did it. We proved it. Your fellow officers are in prison, and we will not accept it anymore. Gloria Amparo Suarez. Leader of the Organización Femenina Popular, the popular women's organization. Everywhere I've been with CPT, we're a foreign organization. People come to us and they see us as a possible means to getting a school built or having a well built, dug, a development program. And we say then to them, we're sorry, we don't have the budget, or that's also not in our mandate. Well, the OFP, they have a mandate to defend life in all shapes or form. And I don't think there's a request that they said no to. And so they are an organization led by women for the needs of women, especially. And so women need holistic healthcare because often the healthcare system does not provide an understanding of the needs of women who are abused or who are forced to flee. Their husbands have been assassinated and are now looking for support. Women who were forced to leave school at an early age and who don't have an education and don't have ways to support themselves economically, well, they can get training. Or they can have psychosocial care. Or they can have legal support to defend themselves against abusive partners. Or they can receive development projects that they can work out of their homes and earn a living to support themselves. Well, Gloria Amparo Suarez is one of the amazing leaders. And one day she's sitting at the desk at the office receiving people. And a young man shows up at her desk, sits down in front of her, and she thinks, hey, welcome. How can I help you? Well, he shows her his cell phone and he says, he shows her a picture, and you know this young man? She says, yeah, that's my son. Well, We need you all here at the Orthope. We're tired of your whining and complaining and your yelling and screaming, and we're tired of you denouncing us. He was a young paramilitary. And said, we need you to shut up and close up shop. And up till then, it was the OFP leaders themselves who were threatened, and they have protection plan in place, and they accept that risk. But all of a sudden, it was now her son being threatened. So she sent people immediately to the university to pick him up, and they brought him there to the OFP. And within a week, because of the amazing support network they have around the world, both of her sons were then sent to Spain for 6 months. She was not going to shut up. And she still has not shut up. Fortunately, her sons returned to Colombia and finished their university and have moved on. And the threats against them were not realized. And the OFPE continues to be one of the most amazing partners we have. Credos, one of the oldest human rights organizations in Colombia, in Barranca, they go into the neighborhoods and document and report on the violations of the human rights violations that take place from all state, whether state actors, the government themselves, the paramilitaries, the guerrillas, and they report it. They report the information. And often everyone denies it, the government denies it, and then eventually, about 6 months later, they just have to admit it because it's clear that this is going on. But Credos is at the forefront of denouncing the situations that are taking place. But because of that, again, anyone who stands up and dares to speak out is threatened. And here is the Credos team last year receiving the National Human Rights Prize. It's a fairly strong recognition in Colombia. This is Pastor Salvador Alcantara from a small farming community of El Garzal and Nueva Esperanza. Well, this is a community, he was sent there 40 years ago. He didn't want to go there. It was El Garzal. It was known for just having mosquitoes as thick as the jungle. And it was flooded every year. It's on the edge of the river. Now there's a dike that protects it. It provides a road for the community to travel on, and it's a dike to prevent the flooding from the river. But he was saying, please, God, no, not El Garzal. But he was called, he was sent there by his church to go pastor a very small church of maybe 15 people. And he swallowed a few mosquitoes and walked knee-deep in water during the flooding season. But one day, a man by the name of Barreto, a man who had controlled those territories, those lands, through violence, narco-trafficking, fled because of the persecution of Pablo Escobar and others, but came back several years later with a suit and tie, claiming to be an honest businessman and with titles to these lands. And said, anybody who stays on these lands, you suffer the consequences, and I've got ways to remove you. When the threats against their lives didn't work, then he found a judge who would give him titles to that land. Well, that is when Pastor Salvador said, I understand why I was sent here. His leadership skills as a pastor then pushed him into being the leader of the community. And threats, again, very quickly came against his life. On two occasions, the community pleaded with him to leave, because the threats were so strong. And he, against his own will, left. But then when he said, I'm going to die being out of my community because my whole system is crying out to go back, said, CPT, can you please just accompany me back to go back into El Garzal? And on both occasions, we said, let's go. And he's back in his community. And little by little, we are looking at possibly El Garzal, maybe in about 2 years, but the process is going along to get their titles. And Barreto is, well, licking his wound somewhere. But here's a man who never been to Bogota, never been to the capital. But a Swiss organization who accompanies El Garzal as well said, hey, Salvador, we'd really love for you to come to Switzerland and tell your story. So here's a guy who lives in 35 to 40 degree weather, is all of a sudden now in the Swiss Alps in the middle of the winter, and he is experiencing a much different climate, but sharing the story of El Garzal in Switzerland. I was hoping to bring him to Canada, but our government has a weird visa policies, and well, they thought he was going to be a 60-year-old man, pastor, with a family in Colombia. Well, they thought he wasn't going to go back to Colombia, so they didn't give him a visa. But yeah. Efraín Payares, an elderly man from the community of Las Pavas. Very similar story of El Garzal, former narco trafficker who fled, came back, thought the land, he deserved it more than the farmers who've been farming it for a long time. Threatens their lives, and again, this is another process that we are hopeful that they will receive titles. But as you see, a very simple farmer, plants his corn by hand, harvests his plantain and his yuca, and fishes out a fish from his pond once in a while, and is happy there. Would like a few more things, basic luxuries such as electricity, clean water to drink, a school for his grandchildren to go to that's not so far, just right there in the farming community. But he plays amazing music of his own composition. He sits there, and when we go out to Las Pavas, he entertains us. He often has a new song that he's composed. It's sometimes something about CPT coming out there and so on. But the Center for Historical Memory in Bogota, who's in charge of, for the past, I think they've been around for about 10 years now, they've been documenting the history of Colombia and the history of the conflict and trying to get as many voices as possible. And one day they said, hey, we have beautiful music being played in Colombia. Let's go get it. Let's record it. And so they came to Las Pavas and said, heard that Don Efraín, Francho, plays beautiful music. And they said to him, hey, would you mind if we record it? So here's a guy who, as you can see, plays a beat-up old acoustic guitar. All of a sudden now has these microphones in front of him and this recording equipment. And two of his songs are beautifully recorded on a CD that got published around Colombia, along with other people similar to himself. Well, in all of their communities, this is, I believe, El Garzal, Phil Hart, is playing with the children. And in all of the communities, in moments where you're walking on the path in El Garzal and I'm in one of those moments in my head and going, why again? Why the threats against Salvador? Or why are we looking at a possible eviction of El Guayabo? When is this ever going to end? Well, one of these little people comes running up and says, hey, Pedro, let's play. And he hears the adults, or she hears the adults talking, because the conversations are never, hey, send the kids away. They're talked about, and okay, Salvador was threatened, and so-and-so was killed. And the children are all present, and they hear about it, and they're living it. And they know when their parents are crying, and they know when their parents are afraid. But children have a beautiful way of simply also enjoying life in an innocent way. And it, well, as it says, until we fully get it, as the children do, we won't truly get it. And so these are the partners in all of the communities that teach us that sometimes we just have to be thankful and play. Thank you. Somewhere here is my ending. Well, another thing that Duque did is the Truth Commission was one of the three institutions set up to kind of in a way of the historical Center for Historical Memory. He cut their budget by 40% and cut their timeline as to where the time that they had to go around and collect the truth. The truth will set us free, and those who have committed horrible crimes are afraid of the truth. But many people, and so the Truth Commission is operating in Colombia, but because many Colombians fled, and many are here in Canada, fled the conflict, the Truth Commission is also working internationally. And here in Canada, many people have picked up the call and are volunteering to be trained to how to collect the testimonies of people. So they said, okay, you're going to cut the budget. Well, some of us are going to be willing to do it for free. And so here in Montreal, in Toronto, and in Vancouver, people are answering the call to receive the training and then go out and collect the testimonies. I also give thanks to the amazing young people who are rising up in powerful ways. Greta Thunberg from Sweden is kind of the most famous activist who is standing up and calling us out, us adults, and saying, what have you done to our world? But there's another amazing young woman, and often the indigenous people are overshadowed by the white settlers. But this young woman here, Autumn Peltier, 15-year-old activist from the, and I'm for sure going to mispronounce this, but the Wikwemkun First Nation community on Manitoulin Island. She's standing here last year before the United Nations and demanding clean water for her communities and demanding a cleaner environment for everyone. So this morning, I give thanks to you once again for opening this space for me to vent a little about Thanksgiving, but also for sharing a Thanksgiving potluck, and hopefully, well, maybe not so much, where I feel like we're bursting, but mostly to share with you the stories of these amazing people who have decided that nothing will stop them from being thankful and hopeful that Colombia will one day live in peace.